Hey, it's Joe Gatto from Impractical Jokers, and I wanted to let you know that you're listening to Iron City Rocks, and Pittsburgh could suck it.
This is Brad Sherwood from Whose Line Is It Anyway? And you are listening to Iron City Rocks. Go Steelers.
All right, Pittsburgh! You wanted the best! You got the best!
Welcome to episode 571 of the Iron City Rocks podcast. I'm your host, John, coming to you from the Iron City of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to bring you the best rock, hard rock, heavy metal, and blues talk on the net. Episode 571, we have one returning guest and a first-timer to the show, but we're going to be talking about two things distinctly Canadian in this episode. We're going to be having, off the top, Colin Mockery is going to be joining us. He was on the show back in October when he was in town to do a show called Hipprov, which was a show which featured improvisational comedy mixed with hypnotism. And he is going to be coming back into town to do a show in April with his longtime partner, Brad Sherwood. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. And then joining us in just a little while, Daniel Buxman, who is an author, has written some really great books on the history of hard rock and metal. He's got a new book out, an amazing new book, on the 50th anniversary of the 2112 album from Canada's Rush. So two great Canadians, Colin and Rush, two of our favorite Canadian imports. So we'll get to Daniel in just a little bit. Now, Colin Mockery, if you follow his career, you may be aware he had a health scare earlier this year, and we talk about it briefly in the interview, so I won't repeat those words. But Colin had to take some time away, and he did the show, as I mentioned, back in October at the Carnegie in Homestead with Assad Mekki, and he's coming back around to do a show with his longtime partner since 2002, Brad Sherwood and Colin Mockery. I've been doing the two-man improv show. This year's show is called Asking for Trouble. It is on Thursday, April 9th at the Carnegie Library Music Hall of Homestead. Tickets available now at librarymusichall.com. So without further ado, we're going to let Colin get you ready for the show. All right, ladies and gentlemen, my pleasure to welcome back to Iron City Rocks. We have Colin Mockery on the line. How are you doing, Colin?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing very well myself. For those not familiar, you had some medical issues earlier this year. I'm assuming all systems are go and you're back to full health now.
Yep, all is good. My retina detached was interesting, but now it's reattached, so it's all good.
Reattached, no ill effects. That's wonderful to hear. You are going to be coming into Pittsburgh to do a show in April 9th specifically, with a name kind of synonymous with you, Brad Sherwood, the two of you coming in. Can you talk a little bit about that show? And for those who may know the two of you, I mean, I don't know, you'd have to live under a rock not to know you guys from Whose Line Is It Anyway. How is this different from that?
It's not that different. We like to say it's sort of a live version of Whose Line, but without the dead weight. You know what I'm talking about. Everything starts with a suggestion from the audience. We have audience members on stage with us for about 50% of the show, helping us out. So it's sort of the same format. Everything is totally improvised. It's goofy. It's fun. You don't have to think.
Maybe the audience doesn't have to think, but I mean, for you, can you talk a little bit about this skill set? I mean, people think of you as a comedian, I think, but not in the traditional, I've got, 25 minutes of kind of canned jokes that I tell from city to city. Can you just kind of dissect the difference between the skill set? Because I think what you do might be substantially harder. Maybe it's not, but...
Yeah, I think it depends. Like for me, stand-up is harder. You have the audience that sitting there. They know mm-hmm. you've written all the material. Yeah. You're using your point of view. So they're kind of sitting back and going, okay, come on, be funny. Let's see what you got.
Yeah.
We have a little more leeway in improv because they're giving us the ideas. So there's a little more vested interest in us doing well. And it's basically, it's just being relaxed enough to walk on stage in front of a paying audience with nothing. And just belief in yourself and belief in the people you're working with that you can come up with funny scenes based on whatever the audience throws to you.
Yeah, to me that sounds scary as hell. Maybe it's a perspective, and you've done this for so long, and with cameras rolling and national audiences and things. But are there things that you kind of have in your back pocket just in case, like maybe things you can say to kind of steer an audience into suggestions, or is this 100% you're at their mercy to come up with funny things?
Yeah, that's it. We're constantly, the only work Brad and I do in this show is trying to come up with ways to ask for suggestions where we're not getting the same thing over and over again,
right,
where the audience actually has to work a little and, mm-hmm. and give us something that will inspire us. So yeah, the less, and in fact, the less we know about a suggestion, the more fun it is for us. Because anything that takes us outside of our comfort zone, it kind mm-hmm. of gets us into a kind of a survival mode. And I think that's where a lot of the magic comes from.
To learn what it is you do, can you talk a little bit about, you know, you've done this for a very long time, obviously, but you mm-hmm. you know, you had to learn this craft. If someone were interested in kind of learning this, where do they start?
Check out your local improv troops. You know, if you're anywhere near Second City, mm-hmm. they certainly have all types of improv classes. And I always tell people, even if you're not going to go in for this as a job, and I highly mm-hmm. recommend you don't, it is a great life skill to have, to be able, yeah. it teaches you how to listen, how to work with people, how to be more confident. So it goes against everything we do as human beings. You're supposed to listen. You have to accept people's ideas and help build those ideas. And that's it. It's really that easy.
Is it something like, I mean, obviously you've made appearances on many different TV shows in an acting capacity. Did you take acting classes as well?
Yeah, I went to acting school. Well, because before, people didn't really know what, when I was in acting school, nobody knew what improv was. It mm-hmm. was came a little later with, you know, with Robin Williams sort of popularizing it, and yeah. Jonathan Winters before that. But it wasn't in the public consciousness, and it was really Whose Line that got that started. So yeah, I was an actor. Thank God improv came along.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you feel like you're in a box when you, when, I mean, obviously you've done many acting roles and had great success. Your resume is incredibly long, but do you feel kind of hemmed in when someone says, here's a script?
It's not hemmed in. I mean, it's a different muscle to use, and you can still find ways to improvise within a scripted piece. You can use the same lines, but depending on how you say it or mm. what you're, you know, if I do this, like I'm paranoid of the guy I'm talking to, or I'm doing this, like I really like this guy and want him to like me too. There's two different ways of reading that line. So you can keep changing and keep it fresh.
Yeah. For those who are going to come out to the show, I know when we spoke about Hyprov, there was a tremendous, you know, a lot of the audience was, you know, potentially pulled into the show. Is this similar? You know, you might buy the cheap seat, but you never know when you're going to be called on to be part of the entertainment, or is this a show where you can kind of sit back and be anonymous in the audience, or should folks come expecting, you know, you never know if.
Yeah. As opposed to the hypnosis show. I mean, that's all a volunteer, mm-hmm. a volunteer basis. This one is a little more, we pick people out, but I mean, I'm kind of watching the audience and seeing, trying to figure out, I mean, it's a crapshoot, to yeah. be honest. You hope sure. for the best. You don't want someone who's going to freeze, but you also don't want someone who's going to go, this is my chance.
Yeah.
So it's finding that balance.
Yeah. So I'm going to get discovered at the Colin and Brad show tonight.
Yeah. It's yet to happen.
Well, you can always hope. Just as an idea, like, do you guys come on, is the show entirely together, or do you guys have bits you do independently?
Yeah, we had come up with sort of a list of eight games, and those games usually depend on what the layout of the theater is or how we've, there's a lot of audibles during the show as, okay, this audience is not going for this type of scene, let's go with this. So it's pretty loose and pretty flexible.
Do you guys have kind of like an unspoken language when you're on stage? You kind of I think of, a band. We do a lot with music. A bass player might look at the drummer, and give him a slight facial tick to say, okay, wrap it up, or we're going to go in one direction or another. Do you guys
Oh,
have sort
yeah.
of, that sixth sense?
Absolutely. I mean, this is, I think, our 25th year of doing
Wow.
this. So we've done a lot of shows together. So, yeah, there is sort of a shorthand where usually there's the nice balance of being totally in tune with them and also the unknown where, what the hell is he doing? Where's he going? And it's nice. It keeps us on our toes.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a certain level of trust I have to assume. I mean, you guys, like you said, 20 some years of doing this, that's substantially longer than most marriages last. You guys are doing something right to do this,
Yeah.
and however many hundreds of episodes you've done of Whose Line, but there's a certain sixth sense, I'm sure. Well, Colin, I want to thank you so much again. You guys are going to be coming in to do this show at the Library Music Hall on the 9th. That is in Munn Hall. For those who in Pittsburgh, there are two library halls. There's one in Oakland and one in Munn Hall. This is in Munn Hall, so we'll make sure everybody gets to the right place. You're no stranger to the venue, so if you've seen you there before, I want to thank you so much for your time, man. And we'll see you in just about 3 weeks.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Goo Goo Dolls, Summer Tour 2026. Headed to the Pavilion at Star Lake, Friday, August 14th. An unforgettable night of hits with Goo Goo Dolls and Neon Trees. On sale now at LiveNation.com. Goo Goo Dolls Live. Part of the Minutemen Workforce Solutions Concert Series.
All right, that's Canada's Colin Mockery again. He will be in town to do a show at the Library Music Hall of Homestead. That's in Munn Hall on Thursday, April 9th. So tickets still available. He and Brad Sherwood. Always a great time if you remember the show Whose Line Is It Anyway. He was also a guest a few times on the Drew Carey Show and has been in countless other TV shows, movies, etc. So Colin, one of the greats of comedy. And then we're going to turn to one of, I think, Canada's greatest exports, excuse me, is Rush. And Daniel Buxman, who is an author who has written some really great titles. He wrote a book on the 50th anniversary of Rush. He's also written a book on Ozzy Osbourne. He's written a book on Iron Maiden at 50, 50 years of Woodstock. So several, kind of major milestone anniversaries with some great artists. And this book that has just been released focuses on one of my personal favorites, which is the album 2112 from Rush. Have a copy of that book. It's amazing. It's got great photography, great insight into not only just the songs, which, as a person, I will freely admit, I'm not always good at listening to the lyrics. It took me a long time to get the story behind Operation Mindcrime 2112. Still trying to unravel the wall. Really appreciate the insight on that, as well as the state of the band. I mean, as you follow Rush, you know that this was a very pivotal album for them as far as even continuing on as recording artists. So there's a lot of backstory that went into that album, and then the story itself of the album. So a great book. It's available digitally, obviously. It's available in hardback. I think it's a no-brainer. You go hardback on this book. We also talk about a forthcoming book he has coming out later this year. I believe it's due out tentatively November 10th about heavy metal's Big Four. So we talk about that as well. So without further ado, I'm going to turn you over to conversation with author Daniel Buxman. Ladies and gentlemen, my pleasure to welcome to the show. We have Daniel Buxman, author of the Heavy Metal Encyclopedia, Rush at 50, and a brand new book celebrating Rush's 2112 on its 50th birthday. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure, and kind of coincidental that you and I are talking on what is the 52nd birthday or anniversary, I guess, of the first Rush album, which was released 52 years ago today. But we're here to talk about your latest book, which is just a really, really cool deep dive into many of us Rush nerds' favorite album, 2112. So let me start by, you know, looking through it. I doing some writing myself, freelance. I look at this book and think, man, this was a lot of research. Was the writing the easy part? Was the research the hard part? Or how would you categorize the effort?
Every minute of it, I would say, from the research to the writing to the editing to all of it, was pure joy from start to finish. And at no time did it ever feel like work. I'm a fellow Rush nerd, just like you. And I could just talk about these guys forever, and I could research them forever. And whenever I see some factoid or little bit of trivia or whatever, then I'm busy for the next 10 minutes checking it out, you know, because I just love them and just have endless stuff to say about them. You know, I'm just doing two books about them. I'm happy to do a third one if anyone wants it, you know. So
yeah,
they're easy to geek out over.
Yeah, I mean, the cool thing with you, and you've also done a book on Iron Maiden at 50, there's a lot of things as time marches on that are turning 50, so you can kind of keep at that theme. You'll be doing the Poison at 50 and the Firehouse at 50, all kinds of things that can fall into that bucket pretty soon. When you started this book, I mean, obviously there's been, and I cannot remember the series of DVDs that were put out. And I know Rush was the subject of one of those, but I believe that was on Moving Pictures. How much of this was stuff you already knew? How much of it was, you know, digging in and you know, going back through old issues of Rolling Stone and Hit Parader or whatever to find out this information?
Well, I mean, I knew the basic story. All of us Rush nerds know, you know, the basic story behind 2112. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what's cool about when it gets to be 50 years, you know, and that number appears on a few of my books, Woodstock at 50, you know, like you said, Iron Maiden at 50. After 50 years, some myths and legends and lore start to accumulate. And there gets to be a legend of the making of the 2112 album. And I really, you know, and that goes that, you know, it's this David and Goliath story, Rush versus the label, like in a very kind of a simplistic way. And it was really great to be able to go back and talk to someone who was actually at the label at the time and really dig into what was it really like? What was the climate really like for them? And I found out that it was just not as simple as the story goes. Stuff like that is really interesting to me. I was really glad to be able to put in the names of some of the people at Mercury who really were like the good guys and were really trying to help them, because they don't get any credit really in the story, and they should.
Yeah, I imagine, like you said, over time, certain things get exaggerated, certain things get understated, certain things get forgotten. I'm sure you, without fail, you have read differing accounts of the same events, I'm sure. So how do you kind of sift through he said, she said sort of, or he said maybe in a lot of these cases, accounts of the story?
I just kind of rely on my journalism background. And if he said something and she said something, you just put them both in. Well, one after the other, and then, you know, then it's just what they said, and you don't have to be responsible for it. But, you know, in the case of, you know, some of the people I talked to, you know, like Donna Halper from WMMS, who discovered the band via the record that is 52 years old today, as you rightly pointed out. You know, I mean, I consider it that, like, she knows what she's talking about. And, if she says something that I haven't heard before, or that's, you know, that just seems a little like, huh, that's interesting, I don't feel the need to, like, find an opposing, you know, someone who would say it's different from what she said. Same with Terry Brown, the producer, Hugh Syme, the album. You know, those people have been in their orbit for, you know, over 50 years. I consider that they know what they're talking about.
Yeah, yeah, that's akin to Moses coming down the mountain with the tablets when you're getting someone from WMMS in that era, for sure.
Yeah, or the producer who worked with them for 9 albums, which doesn't happen. You know, unless you're George Martin and the Beatles, that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Did you spend a lot of time like going back through, and correct me if I'm wrong, I apologize, but were you able to get any kind of quotes directly from the band, or do you kind of rely on old articles, you know, going back and digging through the...
I rely on, you know, the accounts from the sort of people that I mentioned and articles and stuff like that. I have never met the guys from Rush. I have never approached them. And honestly, I sort of feel like until they're done with this tour that they have coming up, it is not appropriate for me to knock on their door and demand access, because in my opinion, they're still grieving Neil until this tour is done. Because I think this tour is necessary for them to put all of that behind them and really find closure. After that, I'll turn up at their houses, you know. But until then, I feel like an outside person, you know, pounding on their door for access, and I just don't want to do that to them. I respect them too much, and I respect their privacy, and they've been through a lot, and I just don't want to be that guy.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. So we'll look for some direct quotes from in the Hold Your Fire at 40 book, maybe. That would be
a 50, maybe.
A fun one.
Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, I was doing the math on it. Hold Your Fire was, what, 86, 87, somewhere in that ballpark?
87. It came out the day I started college.
Ah.
Yeah.
Indoctrination there.
I'm definitely dating myself at this point, but I guess we all are at this point.
I felt old. The Chronicles came out when I was in college. So the book itself is beautiful to look at.
Yeah.
And let me ask you, as a writer, how involved were you in, you know, I looked at just the sheer number of images and think, man, this must have been a lot of work to try to get all this. I realize a lot of them are from Getty. But how much of the layout of the book are you involved in, or is that all you as well?
The design and layout of the book, all credit for that should go to the publisher, to Quarto, and every book I've done with them in terms of design and layout looks amazing. But this one, they absolutely outdid themselves. As far as the photos, all credit for that must go to our rock star photo editor, Stuart Pease, who just, in my opinion, just nailed it. He absolutely nailed it. You know, I mean, I'll say at the beginning, like, we need these kinds of photos, like, focus on this era, you know, and certainly the cover, you know, with these people in space, you know, with the planet up there. I mentioned at the beginning, it would be cool to have a cover that, you know, that sort of has like a 1960s, 1970s science fiction kind of feeling. And again, they just knocked it right out of the park. Like, everything about the visual presentation of the book completely exceeded my expectations. And I'm so happy to have my name on the spine of something like that.
Yeah. I mean, it really does. You know, it almost can't be understated how important that, you know, obviously, you know, there's a lot of books out there that are just completely textual that kind of dive in. I think of the 33 and a third series of books that do an amazing job at dissecting. But this is, I think, you know, I look at this and I think almost of like when I was looking at Getty's Big Beautiful Bass book, you know, it's just, you could just sit and thumb through the pictures, you know, so that's off. And then,
like this.
But, you know, but there's so much meat in there that you bring to it that I think this makes this a you know, double threat of a book. It really, really beautiful
it was my intention to do something really like sprawling and comprehensive, you know, really not leave any stone unturned. or leave any detail out. And, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the Rush fans will, you know, will of course check it for quality and make sure everything is correct and all that. But I mean, I'm pleased, you know, that this, as far as I can tell, I'm not sure what else I could really say about them at this point, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you bring up a great point. You know, you've written, you know, as I mentioned off the top of the interview, the Encyclopedia of Heavy Metal, which is a daunting title to live up to. You've written about Iron Maiden. You've written about, you know, many artists, Woodstock. Does this particular band open itself to more scrutiny from your readers than your other topics, in your opinion?
Yes, 100%. Yes, but it's okay. And no, I mean, I've been taken to task sometimes in the past for some things. You know, I mean, it was funny when you mentioned Hold Your Fire, because in Rush at 50, my last book about them, I was not complimentary about that album because I honestly, it's not one of my favorites in the catalog. Sure. And they kind of came after me for that. However, that's okay, because, you know, the way I see it is just the fans love this band. They love them with their whole heart. And they just want to make sure that anything that's being said about the band is cool. And this is okay, you know?
Yeah.
And it's cool to have that engaged of a fan base, and, you know, who really care about what you say and really want to be in the discussion. They're just much more engaged than other kinds of fans. Even Iron Maiden fans, you know, did not, you know, there were a couple of albums in the Iron Maiden catalog that I said I was not crazy about, and there was no pushback on that at all. Rush
no, I
different.
Think you could probably, yeah, you could say whatever you want about Virtual X and some things like that. But Rush, to me, it kind of reminds me of almost like a sibling relationship. It's okay for me to criticize that album, but don't you say a damn thing about it. I'm coming after you.
Yes.
I think also
their criticisms are correct and yours are wrong. That's another thing.
Yeah.
But it's cool. Yeah, you know, as long as you understand the situation, then it's, you know, I mean, I will admit there were like a couple of reviews at first of the last Rush book where, I was a little like, oh, wow. Okay. That person is mad. But it's all good, you know, and it's fine. And again, it's because they love the band, and I can't find any reason to complain about that.
When you see reviews, and this is a question I've asked many a musician, is it something that at some point you have to say, stop, David, don't read any more of these. This is either inflating your ego, bringing you down, you killing your buzz. I mean, either way, I mean, people can be so nasty, quite honestly, in criticisms, myself included. I've read many things that, like, you know, you make you want to give up. Is it something that is an author, sometimes you can take it for what it's worth and you can draw things from it to improve yourself? Or is it something that the negativity sometimes can just make you want to stop?
No, it's never made me want to stop. And I mean, I would say this to all aspiring authors out there. People are going to say things that are not nice, and you must, you know, kind of armor yourself against that. Also, if you're really, you know, trying to get books published and that sort of thing, publishers will reject you over and over and over and over again. So you should not be in this business in the first place if you can't, you know, somehow compartmentalize negative feedback, because you're going to get it. But I mean, any creative person putting anything out there, you know, you're taking a risk. You're kind of opening yourself up. You know, putting something that really means something to you out there. And it's unfortunate when people don't like it. But at the same time, I have to say that a lot of the criticisms I've gotten, like my insistence on putting stupid jokes in the text, when people call me, when I get called out for that, they're not wrong. You know, those, they're there. Yeah. And I put them in there. So, yes, they are correct. that I make a lot of stupid jokes. But at the same time, I know how much work I put into everything. And I know what I wrote. And it's kind of like when it's done and it's come out and it's finished, you have to just kind of let it go. And yeah. People will criticize it. Other people will say it's wonderful. And you have to just kind of keep it all at arm's length a little bit, or you will give up.
Yeah. No, that's great advice. And it isn't so similar to exactly how a musician would answer. You know,
Rush advice. You know, that's what I take from Rush. They don't care, you know, if people like it or not. You know, in 2112 specifically, the label didn't want a record like that. They wanted something commercial with singles, and they didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sort of prepared for everyone to hate it and for it to not sell one copy. And I really am inspired by that. And I kind of follow that example myself. It's the important part is putting something out there that you believe in. That's what I learned from them. That's what their lyrics mean to me. That's what the lyrics on that album mean to me. And, you know, it's you have to really believe in your vision and really pursue it and really put it out there. Or you're not for real. You know, you're not really doing it.
Yeah, you're pandering at that point.
You're pandering, 100%. And there's no guarantee people will like your pandering. You know, you can pander all you want.
Yeah, or you're chasing what was popular, you know, and that's, you know, and I think if anything, like the late 90s or the early 90s, in some respects, you saw a lot of bands do that. They chased what was popular when they started making the record. By the time they were done making the record, it wasn't popular anymore. It moved on.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you know, you just can't work that way. And like if you're a creative person, if you're, you know, I hate to use the A word, but if you're an artist, you know, you have to just, you know, listen to yourself and believe in yourself. You know, and I mean, there were bands, you know, that I remember from, you know, the early 90s, like you're talking about. Some of them really stuck by what they believed and, you know, put out records that, you know, disappeared because by the time they came out, there had been a shift in what the labels were promoting and what people wanted to listen to. But, you know, 20 years later, or no, sorry, 35 years later.
Yeah.
God, I'm old.
Yeah. 20 sounded better.
Yeah, I like that better. Yeah, you know, you listen to those albums today and it's like, okay, well, that, you know, that didn't connect at the time, but it holds up and it's a good record and they should be proud of it. Where bands that I think, you know, did try to, you know, latch on to grunge or alternative when that wasn't really who they were, you know, 35 years later, they have a crappy record that was an attempt to pander that they can't stand behind. And, you know, you have no guarantees that anyone is going to like what you do. So you might as well do what you like. And hopefully in 50 years, we'll still be talking about it if it's good.
Yeah. Well, Daniel, let me ask you, the book itself, what is the best mechanism for folks to get it for your sake? I mean, obviously it's available on Kindle. It's available at, looks like, almost every major book retailer.
Yeah.
Is there a more advantageous place for someone to buy it to benefit you as the author and the person who did all the work? Because obviously a lot of these retailers are going to be taking cuts. And what is the preferred mechanism from the author himself in purchasing the book?
In this case, anywhere they get it is fine. I would ask only that when they read it and if they think it's wonderful, that they tell their friends and family and buy 5 copies for everybody.
Get it now, get it read, and get it in everybody's hands for Christmas this year.
Yeah, exactly.
What's
early
next
and often.
What's next for you? Because I have to assume, if we're talking about a book that is available now, which it is, your work is, I mean, obviously you've got to do the promotional work, but you're probably already on to your next task. What's next on your horizon, Daniel?
The next book comes out in November. It's called Heavy Metal's Big Four, and it's about Metallica, Anthrax, Slayer, and Megadeth. And then I have something that I've started for 2027, but it's a secret, and I cannot divulge its nature at this time.
we'll know it's Hold Your Fire at 41.
It's Hold Your Fire at 40. You guessed it. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be. How did, you know, an entire chapter on Amy Mann's contribution to the albums. But Daniel, I want to thank you some. Go ahead.
There's good stuff on that record. It's just, you know, just some people wounded me with their comments. So I can never get over it. But please continue.
No, that's okay. I want to thank you so much. The book is available now. It's Rush's 2112 50th anniversary. Daniel's entire books are available, or catalog of books is available on Amazon and many Barnes & Noble, Walmart, you name it. So no shortage of places to get it. I want to thank you so much. And the door is open when the Big Four is out to come back in. We can talk about how Testament should be on that list, but that's a different story.
Oh, you're raring to go. Excellent. Okay, good. Yeah, I'll be there.
All right, from Daniel Buxton, Rush and 2112. 50 years. It's available right now. I'm looking at the listing on Amazon. $37 for the hardback. But a great book. Not just a paperback. This is, you know, a proper hardback with great illustrations and graphics. The cover art of the book is phenomenal. So worth picking up if you're even remotely interested in Rush. And let's be honest, who's remotely interested in Rush? You're either all in with Rush or you're not. So those of you who are all in, I don't need to tell you twice. Rush in 2112, 50 Years by Daniel Buxton, available now. Also, a big thank you to Colin Mochrie. Again, he will be in town April 9th with Brad Sherwood to do their show at the Library Music Hall. The show this year, Asking for Trouble, which is a great name, and sounds like a really great time. I have not personally seen Colin and Brad in the flesh. I've seen them on TV a million times. Looks like an awesome time to interact and a great fun show, a real loose evening, and a great way to spend a Thursday night. So check that out. Again, I want to thank you all for listening. You can get information at ironcityrocks.com. All of our social medias are Iron City Rocks, and you can drop us an email at ironcityrocks@gmail.com. Let us know if you like the coverage of the books, the comedians, metal bands, blues bands, bands that we've not talked about that you enjoy, bands maybe you're tired of hearing about. Let us know. We appreciate any and all feedback. And until next time, thank you so much for listening.